This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Hello, Quivi. I'm Jeannie Mai. I am a television personality. I am a producer. I'm an advocate against human trafficking, a huge advocate for women, by women, and most importantly, I'm a mom of little two-year-old Monaco.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all of. This has been months, perhaps years in the making.
Oh my God. Don't even get me started. Kenneth, I swear if you didn't do this podcasting thing, you should be in sales, door to door. Because whatever you sell, honey, Jeff Bezos, move over. You would rack it up because you are persistent, bruh. And I love it.
Thank you for those kind words. I wanted to start off by saying, you know, nobody who's doing what you do, what I do, start out when we were kids going, that's what I want to do in my life in the future. We don't set out to choose this. And when you were coming up, what did you have in mind that you're going to be doing with your life?
Yeah, you know, you're right that we maybe, especially in this generation, we don't say we want to influence the world and be so impacted by social media and, you know, be a podcaster. You know, that we don't say those things. But I did have a pretty clear idea of what I didn't want. I was pretty hell-bent on what I didn't want to become. And that was, I did not want to become a doctor. I did not want to become a lawyer, which, yes, as stereotypical as it is, those are absolutely the two things that your family hopes and wishes for, because that's the one that gets you to the bank. I did not want to be poor. I did not want to be looked down upon. I did not want to be the quiet one that was more submissive and kind of docile in the room. And I'm saying all these things and I have this look on my face because I'm actually remembering exactly where in my life that I said, I do not want to be that. And I hate to say it, but some of those things at the time were aligned with being Asian or being Vietnamese. Like I remember, I have two sides of my family. I grew up in the Bay Area. I have two younger brothers and a mom and a dad. But by the time I was 9, 10, we sponsored the rest of my family over from Vietnam. So my go, my chú, my cậu, ông nội, ông bà nội, all of them came over. So we had about 15 people living in a 3-bedroom home. And it was litty. I loved it.
Fun.
However, my mom's side of the family is Southern Vietnam, loud, boisterous, in your face, not afraid. And then my dad's side of the family is Nui Bac, very Dang Wang, very Im Lang, very Tu Tu. And I just remember sometimes in my life, I would see the juxtaposition between the two of them. And I'm like, I'm not going to be that. And I'm definitely not going to be this. And when we were, I remember when I was laying in the trunk of my car because we were trying to go to the drive-through theaters. And it was me, my cousin Peter, who's like 11 at that time, and my brother Dennis, who was, you know, a little chubbier at the time. And we're all in the trunk of my mom's Toyota Cressida to try to discount three heads for the drive-thru theater. I was like, I am not going to be poor when I grow up. Like, so all these things that I just said are labels that I did not want to be. So I think today, I do believe that I manifested to be as hardworking and as cutthroat and as hungry, even thirsty for the position I'm in, but with value and meaning. So I'm not just going to make that money because I'm going to marry rich or you know, just take any job that has a lot of zeros attached to the paycheck. It's more about, I'm so determined to be everything I can be. And if I don't know, I'm going to find the right friends to know. I'm going to chat GPT it. I'm going to learn it to get to that place. And I feel that same way since I was a like a hustling 12-year-old till now. And I say 12 because my parents put me in work at 12 with my uncle's jewelry store. And that like built me. That gave me my swag for sure. Working at 12 years old.
Yeah.
Working in a jewelry store. Let's make this clear.
Yeah.
In a jewelry store. Yeah.
Was it a Vietnamese jewelry store?
It was Vietnamese owned because it was owned by my uncle Jesse, but it was a joyeria to the streets. So it was a Hispanic jewelry store. And I say Hispanic because we catered to a fully 100% Hispanic audience. We were nestled at the Newberry. Shout out to the Bay Areans in the house. If you're from the Bay, man, I want to hear it. Where is this posting? Where are my comments?
All over.
Okay, I want the comments loud and proud if you're from the Bay, because if you know, you know. I was right on Aborn and King, which in the Bay was Little Mexico. And I was in the Newberry shopping department store, but it's not. It's like Newberry is like, I would say it's a bootleg Kmart, but it was lit. It was amazing. We had everything, and the sweats, the matching sweat sets that I could buy, Fashion Nova could never. And we had my uncle's jewelry store was lit. It was called King Jewelry or King Joyeria. And it was like, it was a huge, I mean, we had display cases of just stacked chains, big Jesus medallions, your pinky ring, your 14 karat, 18 karat, 24 karat, but we specialized in 14 because it was Latino culture. My uncle was so about it. He had things that we had. A big clientele of ours were like Crips that would come in. And he was repping the blue. He had the blue enamel on rings. And
he was huge. He was Johnny Dang before Johnny Dang.
Dude, Johnny Dang learned from my uncle, bruh. And so what I love about that memory is I know at that time my mom convinced me, coerced me to work with my uncle because I was very, very rebellious then and I was getting into a lot of trouble. Things weren't happy for me at 12, but the happiest place I was going to my uncle's every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to work at his joyeria. And I learned the art of sales.
Yeah.
And when I say sales, it really built who I am today when it comes to representing who I am, meeting any type of person from any walk of life, whether they can speak English or not. It taught me how to hablo español really well. It taught me how to bargain and how to meet people where they are in order to get both of us to win. It taught me how to face it till I make it, not fake it, but face it till I make it, no matter what I'm feeling, how I woke up, what drugs I was on at that time, how hard I was partying. Like, honestly, it because my uncle was like, this bitch is opening at 10 a.m. So I don't know how you're feeling, but you're going to show up and you're going to rep our name and you're going to sell some jewelry and the anillos, the anclas, the 50% off, like everything has to go. And I was eating chicharrones for lunch. And it was a very high energy, amazing experience for those 3-4 years that I worked for my uncle, because I learned how to make money. I learned how to speak and use my voice. I learned how to not be intimidated. Becoming a woman at that time too, when like my body was developing, I was learning how to like fend off men and to protect myself. It was really interesting. So I think that was a big pivotal point of my life.
Yeah, it's crazy because I was going to get into the whole fashion thing and the fashion game. And this gives us a visual root showcase of how that kind of like took shape at such a formative age.
Yeah, absolutely. I really thank my mom when it comes to my fashion game. And my mom for my hustle. And I love my dad for my peace within and my ability to channel what is genuine and what is pure. Like my discernment on that is very rich because of my dad. My mom will take in everybody off the streets into the house and be friends with everybody. My dad is more like, what is more pure here? What is transparent? What is real? And so I had a great mix of both.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat. And when you think back on the Northern experience and the Southern experience, I come from that family as well. And they kind of they're like different countries. The North people are what you said, they're slow, they're methodical, strategic in their approach to life. And the Southern mentality is a little bit more loose, but there's a warmth to it. And I could see that when those two things get together and you could take just the best of these two cultures, it's a winning formula.
1,000%. And what's so incredible for anybody who's visited Vietnam or will, because you have to make it a bucket. It's a must stop in Vietnam, and not just Vietnam, but like you said, going from the South to the North region. I love that you used the word warmth for our culture and our people, because our people are survivors. And rather than being survivors that are cutthroat, may the strongest survive, you know, X everybody out, unless it's about me, my family. No, we're actually much more inclusive of how do we la lang is that word, man. Yeah. Like I heard that la lang cho kong, la lang cho ma bo me. Like that's what we were grown up understanding. And so today, I see that when I traveled from the South to the North of Vietnam last year, once you just offer yourself to say, hey, palms open, I am no threat. Oh, they will take you in and they will just give you the clothes off their back and make you one with them. And it's so beautiful. And I truly love that, especially being, you know, a person in Hollywood where you kind of have to watch your back. That's one of the greatest superpowers I have because of being Vietnamese.
That is such a beautiful memory and a beautiful sort of like homage to the warmth side of the culture.
Yeah.
Now, how did you go from, you know, being this sort of wayward person, wayward teen, sounds like you partied and, you know, there's drugs and all of that stuff, into kind of like really staying on the path to do the hard work, no matter what the temptations came about?
Going back to saying, you know, that my family are survivors, I have no other POV than to make it and to win at whatever it is that we're doing, even if it's the process to win. Like I said, my memory of my childhood is my mom and my dad being together, having me. I'm about 6 years older than my brothers. And so that was probably the most happiest time of my life when I experienced a healthy household, parents being in love, celebrating Valentine's Day and, you know, giving each other chocolates and all the American traditions that this new couple was embracing and loving. That was a beautiful love letter to family and marriage for me. Then my two brothers came and my household became a little bit more stressed. My mom and dad weren't doing well together. We sponsored the rest of the family over. And I'm not saying it's because of the children or the family, but different pressures changed the dynamic of my mom and dad. And so they became unhappy with each other. And what I remember then was, here are 10 new people that came from Vietnam looking to us to survive, looking to us to provide shelter and to teach them the American way. And here's my mom and dad trying to hold down the fort of being the provider and the host, but also trying to manage their marriage and these three growing kids that were very rambunctious and, for me, rebellious, trying to keep us out of trouble and keep the boat afloat. Me, trying to blend my brothers that I felt and am still so close to and responsible for, but making them immerse themselves into this new whole side of our culture that they've never been exposed to. They barely spoke Vietnamese, but I'm the one that got the most saturation of Vietnamese. And then it started to water down as my parents kind of started to have focuses on work. The other family comes in, they're a little bit more Americanized, but here I am trying to immerse them so that this family doesn't feel outside of this American family. And I feel that's who I am still today. I am a television host because my whole life was about making sure that everybody is all right, making sure that everybody feels seen, that they feel heard, that there's no language barriers or misunderstandings, that you matter and you're a part of this. I was constantly the MC of Ba Noi over there, cooking on the stove, but letting her know, French fry hoặc là chiên một chút gì cho mình ăn cho nó dễ được không? You know, like just making sure she understands, like, you know, her ba lúc lắc isn't always, you know, the fave over here with kids that are eating McDonald's. Or making sure that my cousin Peter, who's walking around in his fob shorts all day, like, Peter, you know, you want to make sure you put on some jeans. You know, fashion is so important because it's about representing how you look, who you are, what's your swag. You know, let's teach you to shop at Mervyn's at the time, get you some fly, you know, pair of jeans and, you know, some hoodies and, you know, get yourself to just not feel like you just came out of the streets of Saigon. But how do you also like develop your own personal style? So I was always in that mix. And I really thank my family for that circus of constant education and constant growth and comfort in who we are as Vietnamese people, but who we are navigating America together.
And at what point did you start to drift into the fashion game?
I would say that I'm, as much as, yes, we love a good Hermes, we love a good Birks, but I'm more into style. Style is the name of the game for me. Fashion is an industry. It's a business. It's a brand. Style is a voice. It's a story. So
can you break down the two differences between, because as a layperson, for me, fashion is style, style is fashion, but there sounds like there's big nuance here.
Yeah, no, different. Complete difference between fashion and style. Fashion is an industry and it's a business. It's brands, it's labels, it's marketing, it's being able to buy a Birkin, being able to pair it with your whole look so that you're making a certain statement when you're at the head of the meeting and you're wearing your Jimmy Choo shoes or you're walking into a first date night wearing your Louboutins. There's a label to it that is power, that is wealth, that is prestige. And anybody can buy fashion and step into that world immediately. And there's nothing wrong with that. I do it myself when I need to. Style is your personal story. Style is where you come from, what you speak, how you mix the things that you wore, whether you care or not about what people say about you, how that all comes together and is displayed on you is your personal style. And style is what gives you swag.
Now, the essence of style probably comes from somewhere deep within each of us.
Yes.
And I just want to shout out to your mother, Mama Mai.
Yes.
She's got a lot of style. And so I don't think that your style comes from her, but I think that the effort to project probably has something to do with your mother. Can you talk about the dynamics of your mother and you coming from this idea of style and voice?
Yeah. Mama Mai's style is unmatched because it is fearless. Mama Mai's style is, I came to play. I came to party. You will absolutely not forget who I am from the moment I walk into the door. I don't have to speak or say a word. You know exactly who I am. And she's always been that way. And I think that that is a great foundation of what style should be for everybody. Not that you have to dress like Mama Mai or look like a Mama Mai, but style is a certain essence that when you walk through the door, immediately you're intriguing. Immediately there's something that is spoken about you without having to open your mouth. And that is a magic about style. Mama Mai style, again, coming back to personal story, doesn't just come from the fact that she loves bright colors and glasses and the fact that she wants to get everybody's attention in the room. Mama Mai style comes from being poor, from growing up in Saigon, where she's talked about this. Her father was ridiculously strict to an abusive point. He really confined her to not picking up attention from other men, from not wanting to be loud and distracting, to being a quiet Vietnamese girl who looks dang wang and ngok, word, and save money. So honestly, the other women in my mom's side of the family, they all dress sensible. All of their style, and there's nothing wrong with that, because for them, their style is, I want to be comfortable. I want to make money. I want to go to work. I don't want to have to think about what I have to put on. That's their style. That's totally fine for them. And when they walk in the door, you see that. When they walk in the door, you go, that woman is about efficiency. That woman is here to like get what's done and leave, you know? So I think that when my mom landed in the US and had more access to fabrics, textures, the flea market, the bazaar, Contempo Casuals, a name drop on a store that only 80s babies would know, Judy's, Macy's. When she saw that the world was your oyster, if you just know how to be clever and put things together, she was able to break out of what her father put upon her for all of her childhood and teenage years. The fact that she broke free and landed in America and now could get to make money to buy those gold hoop earrings. She gets to make money, build her independence, and go wear a sparkly glitter shawl in the middle of Ranch 99 Market. Like, she gets to do this. That right of independence was massive for her, because my grandfather controlled her, didn't want her to stay out after school to play with her friends, wanted to make sure that she was home by a certain time, wasn't allowed to date until she came here and met my dad. Like, for such an outspoken, vivacious being that my mom is, that does something to you. That kills you. And so her style today, even today as a 60, I think she's 64, it's still a fuck you to everybody else.
Yeah.
Her style is, why not? That's exactly what her message is every day, and she delivers. And so I think for me, I love and appreciate my mom's style so much, even though we get into a lot of fights about the things I'm trying to throw away and she's going to refurbish it into a hat. Like, I can't tell you how many socks, underwears, nylons I've thrown away, and that shit has ended up on that woman's head. But that is what we love about her. Oh, straight up, like beyond. I remember going to Disneyland one time, and she wanted so bad to match this polka dot top that she had with some type of pattern on her head. And of course I couldn't offer anything. And somehow she went into my then stepdaughter's drawer, pulled out a polka dot underwear and made it into this head wrap. And there we were going to the haunted castle. And she said, "Hey, everybody, you like to wear my head? Look, you think it looked nice?" And we were like, "Yeah, it's cute, actually. How did you find that? Where did you?" "It's her underwear. Don't tell." And we were like, "What the fuck is wrong?" But it's like that type of thing. Like, that's burned into my brain for the rest of my life. And it's what I love about my mom.
Yeah, shit.
Yeah.
Now, when you're describing all this about your mom, I think about the power dynamics just internally, because what she pushes back on is seems so natural. But when I think about the relative sort of position that you're in to the bigger mainstream world of answering to corporate America in the entertainment industry, you probably get a lot of pushback naturally as a woman, as a person of color. And you also probably have this like burning fire to be you. How do you deal with it? And can you talk about some of that throughout the years? Because you seem like a pretty fearless person, but I'm sure you probably get some people at the top going like, calm down, like temper it, you know, cool it a bit. Can you tell me about like sort of like the dynamics that you have with the bigger mainstream sort of ecosystem and actually empowering your own voice and putting it out there?
Absolutely. I distinctly remember when my life took a turn, and it's exactly when I started to be more fearless about my voice. When I was growing up, I left my house around 16 years old because things were really rough at home. I was really upset about my parents' broken relationship, and they were doing the thing where, and I say the thing because my Asian people who are listening may be familiar with it, but when your parents aren't happy, they don't know or have access at the time to things like counseling and therapy. They're not sitting down to have a very Cosby show version of a family meeting to say, hey, you guys, we're kind of struggling. Please be patient with us. Mom and dad are going through some things. So if you guys see us arguing, we're trying to work through. Like, I'm saying this because that's how I would be today. Yeah. I would be very vocal with Monica if I, you know, end up with a husband where we're going through things and I want my daughter to know, like, mommy and dad are just dealing with some things. I want her to see how conflict resolution works. My parents didn't know how to do that. So between hiding things from us kids when they're fighting to being estranged from each other, this is a three-bedroom house, and any home feels energy. Home is energy. And so between my parents struggling to find their marriage and their happiness in the home, to at that time, when I was 9 to 12, I was being sexually abused by a cousin that was babysitting us in our house, and I didn't know how to vocalize that. I had had it, and I was really stripped from my voice and my safety, not because of my parents, not because of the elders, but just because I did not know how to voice the type of protection I needed. And my outlet was going and doing the most radical things, getting tattoos, going to raves and parties, experimenting with different drugs. And so that also was driving everybody in the house afar from me because they were like, how, what is going on with her? How can we help her? You know, and this is like in the 90s and 80s. So you don't have resources to be able to get the help or even the words. I don't even know how to say, guys, I'm being triggered. Guys, I feel uncomfortable in this house. And I'm saying this because these are all things that I journal today to make sure that I'm teaching Monica, because that power of knowing how to communicate what it is that you need is so important. Anyway, I left my house at 16 and I moved to San Francisco, which was also kind of more of a playground for someone like me. But immediately, because I was surrounded by good friends and a really strong community of people who valued me, I found immediately my morals. So I lived with a gay couple who one was trans and one was, they were both gay, but one was trans. And immediately in that household, living on Folsom in San Francisco, I learned the sense of identity and protecting that. I learned that not everybody will accept who you are, and not everybody, more people will be less likely to accept things that don't feel familiar or comfortable to them. So whether it was my friend who was, she was going out and drag every day and living her life transforming, living her life transitioning into a woman, or the both of them being gay together. It was just constant labels being thrown at them and constant having to protect whether we'd have to get up from a restaurant and leave or having to walk a different side of the street because of things that could be literally thrown at them, physically thrown at them. And me having to understand immediately, like, where do I stand in this world of people who judge, people who are being judged, and how I'm an ally in between. you know? So that was a really wonderful time for me to really develop my voice and my identity and who I am and who I stand for and the people I protect. And that gave me the gusto to be more outspoken about the type of way I was going to build my brand and make my money. So at that time, I was really good at fashion and also really good at makeup. Thanks to my mom. I watched hours and hours of YouTubes of her get ready with me's. The amount of get ready with me's I did with her. And when I say this, I can tell, I'm not sure if you know what a get ready with me is. Do you know what it is?
I have an idea. I mean,
it's a get ready with me. Okay. Yes. But like, it's crazy that today on YouTube and on Instagram, all we do are these get ready with me. Like I sat there watching my mom head to toe. So I knew how to contour my face and give myself like these different versions of myself, from dressed up at night to, you know, going out to hustle a business meeting. I just knew how to make myself look really savvy. And so my first job was a makeup artist. I worked at the Benefit makeup counter, the MAC makeup counter. And I was really good at my job because I had the gift of sales. I knew how to like make people feel welcome to the table, especially in an industry like beauty, where sometimes only the most beautiful are seen and paid attention to. And then some aren't, you know, coming in hoodies and are like, oh my God, like help a sister out. But I knew how to relate to all of them. And so my skill set worked really well in a environment where you just had different people coming to you all the time, like the joyeria I was at.
Yeah.
So I worked at the MAC counter in Valley Fair Mall. I worked in San Francisco and quickly became a big position for my age to work with different people. And it exposed me to now celebrities. It exposed me, because MAC was such a huge booming brand, it exposed me to working with bigger names and being out there, where now you're outside of a makeup counter, but you're working, you know, on a trailer of Alicia Keys' music video, or you're on a music video, you know, helping Cyndi Lauper get her signature winged eyeliner. And I'm learning how to carry myself so that celebrities feel close to me and feel comfortable with me. So you're kind of a vault, but you're also, you know, you got this style about you that stands out, so that you're constantly called back again, because celebrities love energy around them. They love either a calming, soothing energy, or they love somebody who's going to like make it entertaining while I have to sit in this makeup chair for 3 hours, you know? And I developed that quickly, and I was promoted immediately to start working with different celebrities. And at the time, because makeup was such a thing, styling wasn't like an actual carved out position. Most of these celebrities would get clothes sent to them, or they would just go literally to the mall, to the stores that I just mentioned, and they would go shop for themselves. And because I did so much shopping with my mom, and I spent so much time helping my mom get dressed for her jobs. I should also mention that that was a big part of my world, because my mom was a working mom for us three kids with my dad. So I watched her prepare herself for different job interviews, and every single interview was a different version of her. She would channel Angela Bauer from Who's the Boss and go with like big shoulders and a briefcase and like glasses to look, you know, executive when she wanted to go for an administrative position. There was another college, a computer business college, where she wanted to be a counselor. So she dressed it. She had her cardigan and she had her pearls, and she wanted to look more warm and sociable. And she went to that version. So I knew style so well based on story that it was easy for me to jump into some of these roles with different celebrities I worked with. I worked with Christina Aguilera, Missy Elliott, Alicia Keys, Cyndi Lauper. And I knew how to take their story and put it into their swag and their style, and go from like Joanne's Fabrics to Mervyn's, Macy's, and get these pieces and style them up. So immediately I became a stylist and a makeup artist in one. And even though I loved working with celebrities, it was so special, I still thought more about the everyday woman that didn't know or have the budget to do this. It was all of my customers at the MAC counter, at the Benefit counter. It was the girlies that would come by for the free samples, but they couldn't really afford a lipstick. So I would give them a free makeover and then hook them up with as much, you know, samples as possible. It was the ones that reminded me of my aunts and my mom at home. And so I said, you know, it's dope to work with these celebrities, but I want to work where I can broadcast my message of how to get the look, how to feel sexy, how to make that money on a bigger level than just one by one on these celebrities that can afford me, you know? So at the time I was in San Francisco, and I was like, San Francisco, the biggest channel for the Bay Area was KTVU, Channel 2. And I would watch the programming and it would be like, I don't know, the news and then maybe the sitcoms we'd watch. And then for some reason, between 3 and 4 o'clock or sometimes 4 and 5:30, there would be just an empty screen with just like a bridge, you know, and it would just be music playing. It was like they didn't have programming there. And I remembered that when I was doing makeup, whether for celebrities or at the Mac counter, every time I would do makeup, I would talk out loud what I'm doing. Oh, girl, you've got these amazing blue eyes, but we can't even see them. So I'm going to layer it up with a beautiful peach that's going to give you a big backdrop for your eyes, make them stand out. I know you're getting married, so we want to see your eyes from the altar. Like, I was just so good at depicting what exactly I was doing that I would always create a crowd around me at the makeup counter. Or even, you know, if I was at the trailer doing makeup on celebrities, they would be like watching me do it instead of just like, I mean, we weren't on our phones at the time. So they would be very engaged in what I was teaching. And I knew I had the ability to teach people. So I ended up going to the KTVU news station. And I pitched to them, hey, I want to do makeup so that I can teach your audience of women how to get their makeup done, how to get these looks. What are the season's freshest trends? And if I can bring you guys money in this hour slot from the brands of makeup I use, would you guys be down for that? You know, like, I was basically talking about engagement. They didn't even know what I was talking about. They were like, it's a screen that's on for that hour. As long as you don't like curse or say anything that's ludicrous where we have to cut you off the air, go for it. And so I hooked up with Matt.
How did you just, here's the big mystery is when people like you say, oh, I just contacted the TV station and I got, and then they explain what they wanted and what you could do. Well, the big mystery is always how the hell did you get a meeting? Because that's the biggest question for any kid or young person coming up. It's like, well, how do you get somebody to just believe that you can deliver? And who did you go to get that meeting?
You just do it. That's the crazy thing about life today is you actually will complicate things more if you overthink how it has to be done. Because the more you just do it, the more you become so numb to rejection that you just don't even care if you get rejected, and the 5 doors out of the 50 that you knock on will open at some point. And so for me, I was so hungry to just walked up to the general manager at Mac, and I said, yo, I sell makeup so well. I came from Benefit. This is how much I sold every day. I have a different style of makeup because I make people stand out more. I make women understand what they're doing. My sales is unbeatable. You got to hire me on to understand what I can deliver. And so the way I pitch myself, again, sales isn't, hey, can I have a meeting with you because I want to talk to you about like how I can possibly get a job here. That's not a sale. A sale for a person is, what am I going to get out of you? A sale is, what am I offering you that you can't get from anybody else? So I knew how to promote and pitch myself in a way that would make you the winner from hiring me, even though I'm the one that wants the job, even though I'm the one that's in need of the money. So I think that was like the one thing I knew right away, because being Vietnamese and also coming from such a boisterous, crazy household, whether it was the hate we got from our neighborhood, like sometimes I remember this guy, I won't name his last name, but his name is Travis. And he would always hate on my house and how like loud we were, or how many cars were parked on the driveway, or how he just didn't like that there was so much action at our house. And I was like, yo, are you crazy? Our house here next to you, you're missing out from so much fucking food that's happening every single day. You could literally come in and have a different meal off a Vietnamese menu every day and never repeat the same meal. What are you having on your own? McDonald's that's down the street? You know, the taqueria can only offer so many versions. Like, come to a Vietnamese home-cooked meal and you will experience a whole different thing. And when you come in, we got karaoke for you. We got 50 different, like, apparatuses of transportation, from the Hyundai to the scooter to the skateboard, you know, like, to the moped. Like, we got so much. And I sold to him why we were such a lit house. And he became one of our favorite friends that came over to the house all the time. So I think, like, that survival conversion got me. In any scenario, when I walk in, I'm like, let me tell you why you want to work with me. Let me tell you why I'm about to bring you the party. You know, but
how did you get the meeting at KTVU?
At KTVU. So I remember I still remember his name, Dave. I walked in and I remember I said,
who just cold walked into a TV station.
Yeah. Yeah. So I looked it up. We had the yellow pages back then. Remember that? So we had our Google was the yellow pages. And I looked up KTVU, the station, the street that it was on. It was actually outside of San Francisco a little bit. And I remember driving there and parking and going up to the woman at the front desk and asking, like, who's in charge of what programs are on TV? Like, who's in charge of that weird bridge that comes on every day at 3 o'clock? And she was like, I'm not really sure. She gave me the head, I don't know his position, the head person that was in charge of that channel. When I told him what a waste of time that was and how much more fun it was to have something entertaining to watch and how cool it would be for a bunch of women to actually tune in and get like a quick makeup lesson and why not be associated with these brands that might be able to either give away free products or give away money in order to get their products to be promoted. And why wouldn't I be the best person to do it? Just me talking is my sales. Just my energy serving it and having the confidence to know what I'm talking about is already like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I'm not into makeup, but you're very interesting to watch. So fine, get your ass up there and let's see. And then you got to go for it though. That's the other thing. Like, you can't just sell all this game and then come through and not be that person. And I think that's why every single opportunity in life is already the audition. Every single opportunity in life is the interview. Even if nobody's watching, everything you're doing is getting your game straight, getting your swag right, getting your gift of gab on point so that when that opportunity comes, you talk like you've done this a million times before because you've done it. And that's why Vietnamese people are so boss at that. Whether there's one customer or there's a bunch of children that need to be fed, Vietnamese people will come through and deliver. You see it when you walk into our country. The minute you get out of the airport, the sales has begun. Like the business is popping and people are promoting, doing, fixing, repairing, serving, polishing, whatever it is, because they're just doing it. And I think that part of that Vietnamese within me is what made me such an amazing spokesperson for Genie Mai, because I'm doing it and I'm showing you in real time and you get exactly what you asked for.
That is an unbelievable point of view to say, you know, I'm just going to look these people up in the yellow pages, open up the door, walk in and just pitch, because yeah, that's what really separates people, is that sort of that initiative that we have, that belief in our own self that we can deliver, right? Because, I mean, did you come up with a pitch deck at the time? Probably not, right? It's just like verbal?
No, no pitch deck, but you're not wrong in the one thing that you just said, which is so crucial above the skills and the gift of gab and the delivery, is the belief in yourself. The belief in yourself is monumental. That confirmation in who you are, why you deserve to be standing here, what gave you the gusto to actually sit here and say you can do it better than anybody else. You got to talk that talk so hard in the mirror that you absolutely, without a blink, can deliver that straight to the person in front of you without wavering. And even if you don't know something, even that is an assertion to yourself. Even that is a, I don't know, but I promise you I can be the one to find out. And I promise you I can be the one to go through all the angles I need to go through to deliver what that job is. Like, just that belief in yourself. It doesn't have to be that you know all, do all, it can be better than anybody else, but that you are the best of yourself. That right there is crucial to deliver whatever it is that you do.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam. that, Jeannie, is, I'm going to just straight up say it, is what we're missing. The Vietnamese American mentality almost. I mean, we live on the business side and we do the work, but we don't have that, like, I'm going to look up in the yellow book and I'm going to yellow pages. And I'm going to look up that person I need to, the GM of the station, and I'm going to just march right in. And that belief that those things are possible is why I do the podcast, because to hear somebody like you tell that to a young woman who's listening to this right now, whether they're in Vietnam, Canada, or the United States, that's something we're missing. And we just got to, like, be straight up about why we're missing that. You know,
that's that's a good point. I do see that missing in our culture.
Yeah. We got this modest shit. We got, we don't.
Yeah.
But the way you're saying is like, no, I'm going to deliver something to you. You're going to benefit from my involvement. But see, that's sort of like the paradigm shift that we in the entertainment business today need to kind of shift. And, like, you know, the ones that are successful are the ones that have that, like, that visualization process. Like, I'm going to be there and this is how I'm getting there. I'm just going to, like, knock on the door and I'm walking right in. And that's missing. And, you know, frankly, I think we find a way to adjust that, like, now in this conversation, and help the younger people who are listening to kind of be this way.
Right. And that's why I said, going back to what I said earlier about, not to take it from Nike, but just do it. Like, just doing something instead of
thinking about it,
lamenting about it, talking yourself out of it, comparing yourself to other people and how they would do it, or even just sitting there being sedentary is such, it will kill you. It will literally kill your human spirit. Because when you just do it, even when you get rejected, you need, rejection is so good. Rejection is the best gift you could possibly get, because it wears down that fear of being rejected. So what happened? Are you in any other different position than you were 5 seconds before you got rejected? It's only a good check to your ego to tell you, are you more a bit embarrassed about being rejected than the actual rejection itself? Because rejection only means, how do you now, oh, great, so this didn't sound good to you. How do I take this and repackage it? Maybe add some more shine to it, polish it up in a different way so that it doesn't deserve to be rejected the next time. Rejection is such a great opportunity for you to take a nice deeper look into whatever it is that you are presenting to make it better. And so the only way you can get rejected is if you just do it. And I think that Vietnamese people, and this goes back to survival, if we go back to, like, our moms and our dads, our grandfathers and grandmothers, they come from a time in a country and a war-torn survival where just do whatever you can to make it. Just do it and don't try to break out of the mold. So when you go to Vietnam, you'll see 50,000 pho places in the same street. You'll see here 20 nail salons on the same block that are doing the same thing. Like, it does take that one that's going to come out and say, hey, I'm not going to sell jewelry to my own community. I'm going to go into a different community, offer the amazing jewelry and prices that we have to the Hispanic community, and stand out in a different way and learn the language and speak their language and invite them into our culture to be able to make this jewelry stand out differently. Like, how do we stand out differently as a Vietnamese culture so that we're not staying in our comfort zone and our safety of just one another? That is the big golden pot question for us to be able to do more. And I think what I can just say for women is, even here in 2024, we are just starting to find the voice of becoming a culture that is taught to speak out, speak for, speak against, that anything being asked of us to refrain from being the wholest part of ourselves is actually not helping us at all, especially at a time when Asians need each other the very most, because we are all watching each other to inspire ourselves. And so whatever it is that you do, even if you fall flat on your face, you could be inspiring somebody else to just try it and take another swing at it, you know? And so I do agree with you that that's a huge need in our culture, especially in this generation.
Yeah, I think that you have been blessed with a lot of just different experiences that sort of buttress the voice that you have. And it's, you know, brought you and pressured you to kind of react in your, when you were 12, 13, 14, growing up, that has given you license to be free and be you. But that's not the, the typical growth cycle and trajectory that young men and women in Vietnamese second generation, third generation homes are experienced, where we conform and we're just not really vocal about our creativity. And it, creativity lives in all of us, but the license to kind of be it and project it is not there. And to hear your story, I hope it lends strength and courage to a lot of young men and especially women who are on their path to doing creative work.
Yeah. And know that it's a journey. It doesn't mean that I've made it, because I see me today in you know, the television programs that I do and all over social media, however you see me, but know that there are also other avenues. I'm still learning to find my voice. There are also still places where I'm still learning to speak out and represent Jeannie Mai in the best way that I can. And the only way I can help myself is to continue to scare myself a little bit and to just step out of that zone, to be vulnerable. I think that being vulnerable is part of the hiccup too, with the Vietnamese culture being more outspoken, like being able to say, I'm afraid, or I'm really nervous, or I don't know who to turn to about this, or I am missing these things that I would need to reach out and get some help from someone else to learn. Like, those are also things I don't see in the culture. And I wish we could change that. I want us to reach out more and to lean on each other more and to be straight up vocal about what is scary, you know, what makes you feel afraid, because it takes somebody else to lean in and say, hey, I've done that before. I can help you with that one part. Let me assist you. And I feel like we're kind of doing that in our circle that we're in. Just recently, a couple of weeks ago, we went out to a Lunar New Year dinner, and I loved it because it was all different people. I don't know if you knew the whole table, but I didn't know that many Vietnamese people that were in our industry. But what you noticed happened at the end was probably the most magical part of the dinner, which was after, you know, we all, like, very Hollywood industry, we all come in, we all say hi, we take the pictures, we sit down, we all eat. And you could see that it could have just got up and left right at that point. But what happened, and this was shout out to Thuy, everybody kind of stood up and said a little bit about themselves. And you saw something that we all related to, maybe the little nervousness it is to get up and like, hi, I'm Jeannie Mai, and to speak to this table. And we also talked a little bit about the humor with being Asian, with being Vietnamese, another relatable thing. And before you know it, at the end, everybody stayed after the dinner, just talking to each other and hooking up and giving each other's numbers and all that, because that moment broke the mold. And in Vietnamese culture, do we do that enough? You know, when I see everybody goes to only their houses that they know and they talk to, everybody at the grocery stores only get their things and they go home. There's not enough of a blend and an immersion and a checking in. How are you? How is that business venture that you tried? Or you look like you're really unhappy with your job right now. What can I do to help? What else are you good at doing? Maybe I know a guy. Like, if we had more of that taking risks motivation would be heightened, you know, because we feel a support group. We feel somebody calling to check in on how that was. And I think that Vietnamese people, there is a bit of a pride to do things all by yourself. And that's where, you know, the struggle is real.
Well, it's changing, and we are at the ground floor of that change. Yes. I think people like you and Director Bao Nguyen and a number of other people in this business are doing, you know, setting intentions for the future. And I think that bringing in the younger voices are key and crucial to really fostering this new generation.
Absolutely, which is why I thank you for podcasts like this, because this is what gets us there to talk about it.
Thank you for coming on. I want to do a, it's like a random question, but it's been brewing in my mind for a long time. And I talk about it on the podcast, which is this idea of AI. And the reason I want to talk to you about it is because this morning before our podcast started, I had a conversation with the film director. He came over to my house and we're just shooting the breeze. And we're talking about like the direction of where creators and people who do content are heading. And he said to me, he goes, well, like the people who are doing the service on the entertainment side are kind of screwed because of AI. But then he goes, people who are like in front of the camera or creating it, like you, Jeannie, is probably going to be a little bit spared by the AI, by AI and the technology. But I don't know if you have you thought much about our work as people with voices and sort of like the direction, trajectory of hosting and all of the things that are involved in the AI in the future of our work in the media space?
I have thought about it to the extent of how much it's benefited me and what I've liked about it. Having access to AI and having such an immediate generated response to every question I want to know is phenomenal. Like that, for that part of AI, I absolutely love. When it comes to the parts that I think you're referring to where AI could take our place.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Right, right. Yeah. Look, when it comes to technology, we know that technology is always catapulting us into a more evolved place as human beings, right? It's helping us. It should be helping us as a culture, as a people. When it comes to AI replacing us, for me, I personally connect with people based on what's actually heart beating, blood flowing, real. I actually connect with what strife that person has gone through, what moment of a human error they might have in that performance that's going to be lovable and endearing, what way they take a script and pour into it from their own, because we know that they just came from very public divorces or a severe loss in the family. When it comes to AI replacing that person, I don't see it affecting me because I'm never going to attach to an AI version that is an AI version of a human being. Never, because when I'm not here for perfection, even if you make an AI personality to have flubs, it's they're all man fed, you know, so there's nothing to it that would make me afraid of it. So for me today, Jeannie Mai is so full of fuck ups. I mean, just Google my name, you'll see plenty. But I'm so human with my own delivery of my perception of things on any given day. By the way, you could never feed me through an AI and get the same. Like if we did this podcast tomorrow, it would be completely different,
right?
Because
right.
I'm going to have the same stories, but there's gonna be a different mood. There's going to be a different energy. When before we started this for 10 minutes, I told you exactly why I was going through what I was going through, that you're going to get something a little bit more raw or, you know, real today. So I think with AI, I don't fear it as far as replacing people, but I do think it's going to replace the amazing skill sets and tasks that people can do so well. Because we're going to look more to the robotic engineered versions of efficiency to get things done quicker. So it's going to replace the mom and pops that create products and things. And for that, that's sad. However, I do think that when it comes to the evolution of technology, I think it's, again, an invitation for us to step up our game and come out with ways that still preserve the human connection in every product and every, that's why we buy custom made things. It's why we buy handmade. It's why we still will stay loyal to the people that you follow on Instagram. I mean, there's AI generated fashion personalities and things like that on Instagram that I'm not really following because even though they're dressed really well, I want to see how so-and-so does it, knowing their budget or knowing their personal history. And so I don't know. I'm not so afraid of it yet, but I do love the efficiency that AI can provide.
Right, right. Thank you for that. That's such a random thing, but it leads up to another thing, which is this idea of like, we're an amalgamation of all of the things that happen to us. And I think something that you and I share in common is our childhoods were, we were immersed in the Latinx community. We were immersed, for me, I was immersed in the Black community. And I think that a few years ago, up to a few years ago, my speech affects, the way I spoke, really reflected where I grew up with. And I didn't really kind of understand that the things that I was saying was offensive or appropriating. Mm-hmm. And I could see glimpse of like, sort of like this flair that you have that is reflective of sort of a shared past that you and I might have of that, the world that we grew up in.
Right.
When is it, you know, I'm sure you've probably seen comments on your page, and I've seen it, you know, in my life. When is it okay to kind of bring in the cultures that we grew up with in our speech affect? And when is it not okay?
I grew up in a straight up Black and Hispanic community. My neighbors, we had one Vietnamese family, shout out to Long, on the end of our road, but everybody else was either Black or Spanish. And I loved the melting pot that I grew up in. I loved whatever it is that I picked up, a 7-year-old genie running around, mm-hmm. picking up stray cats, riding my BMX, learning how to ollie with my skateboard with all my friends, like whatever I picked up, it just, here I am, right? And you're right. The responsibility today, now that we are so much more informed with where certain words come from, certain swag comes from, I think the most important thing that's our responsibility to do is to acknowledge how we grew up, who we grew up around, and what is coming out of us by straight up giving credit where credit is due. I'm not going to say like my entire personality is because of these Black and Spanish communities. I'm going to say that I grew up in San Jose when it was predominantly Black, Hispanic, and Asian. And what you get is the evolution of where I grew up from. But I'm always going to acknowledge that those were the roots. And so you can put it together, you know, how this girl grew up listening to Run DMC and Too Short and definitely favored hip hop and definitely, you know, was surrounded by a lot more of those cultures. And so it makes sense to where I am today. I think the part where we miss and we can appropriate is when we don't understand the history and the strife that certain words and certain ways of representing a culture came from.
When is it appropriate for us to wear? Oh yeah. And I asked you this because you're always in the public and you're always on the red carpet. And I am getting invited to these like galas and these events that are in the mainstream, but I want to wear my oh yeah everywhere. But like, I don't know if it's appropriate. And this is a conversation that I want to grow over time, because I think that we deserve to kind of put on whatever garment we want, but also it just needs to be appropriate as well. So I want to get your thoughts on that.
I think when it comes to garb of your own race or whatever it is that you want to take from your own race, as long as you understand the history of it and it's not something you're doing disrespectfully, I say if it's coming from your own representation, you get full permission to ride that to the stars and moons above. Like, I don't see any problem with that. But for example, I remember there was an artist, I can't remember her name, but there was an artist who wore an áo dài in Vietnam to a performance, but she like skipped the pants and only wore the áo dài.
It's like Ariana.
We love her for wearing the áo dài. We love that she busted out and tried to represent, but then she put a little salacious twist on it that could be seen as inappropriate because we are a bit more of a modest culture.
We're disrespectful.
And so, right. So, you know, your cupcake chilling out there when it's supposed to be normally like covered, and now you're drawing more attention to the garb because it's missing one full piece to it. Like, that doesn't feel respectful. That doesn't feel, you know, wholesome, or not wholesome, but it doesn't feel like you took the time to realize like what the pieces mean together. And it was more about you styling it your way that you wanted to do rather than representing our culture. That's what it's taken as. I don't know if that was her message. So when it comes to us, if you wanted to wear an aoyai every day, everywhere, I mean, I feel like, Kenneth, because we know your roots, it would actually open up conversation and be like, whoa, this is dope. I don't see men in aoyais ever. Why did you choose to wear this? And how did you put your spin on it to modernize it? I'm sure you would probably, if you did modernize it, what would that be? You know, I think that it would show because of who you are and because you're Vietnamese, whenever you wear things of your own self more. So I think people are actually really enlightened and attracted to it and are like, whoa, you made that look cool. That's so dope that you put them on with your dunks or whatever it may be, you know? So I think it's all right when you are of the same culture representing because you're proud about it.
You have a long way to go with, in terms of like when you can stop working, right? You have another, let's say 40, 50 years of life on earth.
I don't even know if I'll ever want to stop working. I love working. Yeah.
And you've done a lot, but
thanks.
Do you have more vision for where you want to go with your life? What more is on the horizon for you?
Absolutely. Thanks for asking. I love creating, even though I love hosting television and I love bringing my energy to any programming and making it a lituation. I think that's so fun and I do that well, but I want to actually create more when it comes to producing programming that I want to see, producing programming that tells more stories. And one big, huge priority of mine today is mental health. I am coming out of a very difficult time in my life right now with my divorce. And when I look at my 40 years of my walk from getting myself out of, you know, a broken household to get to where I wanted to be in this industry of Hollywood and the limelight, but then having to really define myself and shed the expectations of other people when it comes to being an Asian woman or being, you know, a woman in general, and then having to navigate love, even though I've never seen a healthy version of love in my childhood, navigating that to having some very public fails that are very difficult to manage being a new mom and also being Jeannie Mai and the person who's always smiling and always seems to have it together. These are all things that really affect my mental health and come from the outcomes of these things are from my mental health. So right now, what you're going to see from Jeannie Mai is a huge incorporation of how to become my healthiest, most confident, most healed self because of the things that I've gone through and because of the things I still don't understand. Like when I die, I want to have the most phenomenal relationship with my mom that I've never had in these 40 years. I want to have the best relationship with my daughter that I've never seen on a scripted TV show, that I've never seen at home in my own household, but not because it's perfect, but because it's real and it's connected and it's safe. I want to be in a relationship that is actually genuine and most unique to what I understand is true love and what is safe. Like I didn't see that growing up. I didn't see that in these marriages that I've come out of. That would probably be my biggest goal is to really not only learn to understand what healthy love is, but give it to myself in the most purest way to then give it to my daughter, to then learn and find it myself. That's actually the real goal in life. It's not to win another Emmy or to do these things that I've done so well and I'm so thankful for, but it's really how do I die being at peace with the things that I know about myself, the things that I don't know and I wrestle with, my fears, the things that haunt me. I want to be at rest with those things. And I feel like that's the actual win in life. So today my work is going to represent a lot more of mental health. I'm actually working right now on a couple of things that are going to come out that I'm partnering with in order to help make mental health and therapy more accessible to people, help the language and the process of finding love more understandable and more friendly and not so daunting, make the dating world something that's much more real and genuine. Those are the things that I'm about.
I appreciate that. That's a vision of becoming more authentic with self and enlightenment.
Yeah. Authentic. Great word.
Jeannie, thank you so much today. It's always fun bumping into you in public and hanging out, but we can never have this sort of like these revelations, right? Like as we do, you know, it's an intention to sit down and really get to know your life and your work, and the root of where all this stuff comes from is what I'm like always interested in. So thank you so much for sharing today.
Thank you for having me. I love you. I love you so much. And I appreciate what you do for the community. What you just expressed there is the reason why this podcast is so important. I want to hear every version of stories that come from our culture, because no two are the same. And we wouldn't be able to hear enough of these stories because we don't already get to see enough of what Vietnamese being Vietnamese means. So I really appreciate you having this podcast and having me on. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeannie. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.